So you say you believe that?
No. But Isaiah did. Now, the only record we got in Genesis is men. Masculine, I guess. Demons, angelic beings, watchers, whatever you want to call them, depending upon which literature you're reading, desiring the daughters of men on the earth, cohabitating with them and producing giants. But they also had in their pantheon of demons Lilith. Now, when a man saw a Lilith coming, he better grab his vital parts and run. You think I'm far out? Isaiah was. I never done this before. I mean, Isaiah could have picked a different word. Now, I'm going to pass around by that. Now, I'm telling you about some strange goings on in the spirit world. I haven't introduced you to a Lilith yet. I think that's what we got on the phone, is a Lilith. Remember, we got five people that give us trouble, and one of them is a Lilith. Of that, I'm convinced. She's been trying to get to me for years. And I just now recognize what she is. She's a big old mean Lilith, that's what she is. We get done, all five of these periodic botherers of us on the telephone, we'll find them right here in this list. Them Liliths. That's why she gets so vile with some of you ladies that are in the room with me here. You don't have a problem with me, but she does. She's a Lilith. And she hadn't thought above her belly button in years. You say, you're off graphic, so who's Isaiah? I mean, it's a mean, mean she-devil. Am I boring you? Then you got Mobbet. You remember Lilith and look out for her. One of them creatures. Their breath will kill you. Ain't no screech owl. Mobbet now. I'm trying to tell you, there's lots of different words translated demon and devil. You miss the hierarchy in the King James. Thanks be to God, I've missed Lilith. Mobbet. The ordinary Hebrew word for death is also the proper name of a Canaanite underworld god, the enemy of Baal in the Ugaritic epic. The proper name, not the common noun, should probably be understood in Isaiah 28:15-18. We have made a covenant with death. Remember that verse? You don't make a covenant with death. They made a covenant with that which in modern literature is referred to as the angel of death. That particular one, so often seen in modern caricature and cartoon as the black-robed figure with the sickle, the one that had, see, until Jesus died at Calvary and took it from him, Satan had that power that brings the greatest fear to man. He had the power of death. And in their ancient pantheon, there was a specific agent of Satan, or agents of Satan, that carried that name of the demon death, the death demon. He came to snatch the life. Jesus took the keys of death, hell, and the grave from him, took that power over man, and can now offer you life. But again, it's in the demon pantheon. Death has come upon our windows. And the firstborn of death are references in Hosea and Job. In every case, it's not the event of death, it's the carrier of that power of death until Jesus took it from him. Reshep. In English letters, R-E-S-H-E-P-H. Reshep. Another major god of the Canaanite religion who becomes a demonic figure in biblical literature. Reshep is known as the god of plague over much of the ancient Near East. In Habakkuk 3:5, Yahweh, Tetragrammaton, we translate it Jehovah. Habakkuk 3:5. You know, you read the Bible through and 72, and you just race right past these things. Habakkuk. You go here with all these little guys. Minor prophets. 1009, if you got a Bible like mine. Let's start with the third verse. God came from Teman, and the Holy One from Mount Paran. Selah, think of that. His glory covered the heavens, and the earth was full of his praise, and his brightness was as light. He had horns coming out of his hand. The alternative translation, bright beams out of his side, and there was a hiding of his power. Before him went the pestilence, and burning coals went forth at his feet. Alternate translation for colds is diseases. So in front of him goes pestilence, and burning coals, or diseases at his feet. You know what the literal is? Yah was on the warpath and is preceded respectively by Dever, D-E-V-E-R, and Reshep. Demonic, living persons who brought with themselves pestilence, who brought with themselves plague. Pestilence is Dever. Coals, translated in the King James, in the margin, diseases. Literally, plague. But the word is a name. They were both proper names. You know the difference between a proper name. Zimmerman's a proper name. It's German for son of a carpenter. The proper name is applied to the person who got his name because of what he does. In the original text of Habakkuk, God has a couple of attendants with him. A bringer of pestilence, a bringer of plague. And the names used are ancient names of demonic figures in the pantheon of God. You say, well, wait a minute. Why would they be there in God's presence? Well, the sons of God gathered in the book of Job. There was Lucifer, Satan. And God said, you consider my servant Job? And Job, and God says, Satan says, yeah, I see him. You let me at him. God says, okay. And Satan smote Job with boils. Now, you say, you believe God be walking around with any such creepy characters? Doesn't matter what I believe. Habakkuk did. And if he was inspired, God meant us to believe. In this case, Yah was on the war path and is said to be preceded and followed by respectively Deber and Resheph. Deber is also mentioned in Psalm 91, 5-6. Thou shalt not be afraid of the terror. Pahad is the name. A proper name of a demon who brings terror by night. Nor for the arrow, Hez. A proper name for a demon who smites by day. Nor for the pestilence, Deber, that walketh in the darkness. Nor for the destruction, Ketev, that wasteth at noonday. Not only Deber, but also other words italicized, the ones I just emphasized, have been plausibly identified as names of demons. The personification of these overpowering evil happenings. And then Azazel. I could go on as 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. This is heavy stuff. I'm the one to give you a taste of it. To simply point out, I'm not out in left field. This is a subject long overdue to receive some intelligent treatment by the Christian church. And it isn't something you just get up and roar and spit about. These are evil forces. Now, that story I've been reading you, am I boring you?
No, sir.
In New England. You say, this is the craziest thing I ever heard. You believe in those supernatural beings? Well, I don't believe what I've been reading, but it's true. And what I've been reading is dimmed alongside the attitude about demons that Habakkuk and Moses and David the psalmist and Isaiah the prophet had. They lived in a world where they described and believed there were flying female demons that cohabitated with men. Hairy, cloven-hoofed demons. Personified evil beings that bore pestilence. This is body and soul. Biblical frame of reference. And I haven't even touched the New Testament where Jesus, and tonight that is, I haven't touched the New Testament where Jesus went around and cast demons out of a boy where the demons talked to him and said, our name's Legion because we be many. This is the biggest lie I've ever read in my life. If it's true, it's the scariest thing I ever read in my life if you don't have protection against such things. The devil in Connecticut. AM, September 9th. Oh, I don't want to read that one yet. Friday, November 20th, 1981, Arnie Cheyenne Johnson. In New England, in Connecticut, see what city the trial was held in. Danbury, Connecticut, Superior Court. Now, I have enough people in Danbury and Brookfield. Check all this out for me. Danbury, Superior Court, far end of the city's main street. October 28, 1981, a trial began for murder. Friday, November 20th. The jury gave its sentence. Guilty. Manslaughter in the first degree, not guilty of murder. Arnie Cheyenne Johnson's life was ruined. The penalty the judge levied on him for showing compassion in a closed room during a private tragedy in the summer of 1980 was one entirely without mercy. He was given the maximum sentence possible. Arnie Johnson was sent to jail until the year 2001. The devil had won. Who's Arnie Cheyenne Johnson? Wednesday, July 2nd, 1980. Turn the lights down. Began normally for Debbie Gladsell. She rose early. I'm reading The Devil in Connecticut by Gerald Brittle, same author, co-authored with Ed and Lorraine Warren, one that dims the Donovan House case. Wednesday, July 2nd, 1980, began normally for Debbie Gladsell. She rose early, filled the trunk of her car with clothes and cartons, then drove 20 miles south to Bridgeport to pick up Arnie Cheyenne Johnson, named when he was born for Cheyenne on the TV series, with the hope by his parents he'd grow up calm and cool like that character. She drove 20 miles south to Bridgeport, Connecticut, to pick up Arnie and Jason, her son, and their sheepdog, George. By 10:30, all were traveling north on Route 25, heading for the house in Newtown. Debbie was the son. Carl and Judy Gladsell. Longtime residents in New England. She had moved in to a family sharing rent. The mother of Arnie Johnson, one Mary Johnson. They were living together. Very much in love. To save money, they had rented a country house in Newtown for $500 a month, including utilities, they thought, with a little side apartment into which Arnie and Debbie, the daughter of Carl and Judy Gladsell, could move and live. And Mary Johnson, the mother of Arnie and the younger kids, could live in the main house. And the mother, Mary, of Arnie, was suffering some severe physical ailments. So they had talked and decided this would solve some of their budget and personal pressure problems. And happily, they're driving to the new house. The temperature was 90 degrees and climbing when they pulled into the driveway. Hot, mucky summer in New England, shortly before 11. "Is this where we're going to live now, Mommy?" asked Jason, leaning enthusiastically over the back seat and gazing wide-eyed at the house. "That's right," Debbie answered. "Do you like it?" "Yeah, I do." He jumped out of the car and ran up the long dirt driveway, followed with a playful sheepdog. Debbie and Arnie got out of the car just as eagerly. Arnie, the only man in history, to my knowledge, in modern America at least, convicted, charged with murder and convicted of manslaughter, whose only defense, he was possessed of the devil. He didn't do it, the devil did it. Now, I know the devil made me do it, no joke. Well, you hear this story. The judge refused the plea. On a technicality, kicked it out after the trial was in progress and a court-appointed attorney was informed by the judge that he had failed to file the necessary forms to plead insanity, and he put devil possession in the category of insanity, denied him that plea, and left him helpless before the court. Sentenced to prison till 2001. This story is the prelude to that. Yeah, I like it. Debbie and Annie got out of the car just as eagerly as the boy. Arnie Johnson is a short, muscular young man with bushy blonde hair and a quiet voice. Though he's only 18 years old, there's strength to his face. Arnie hasn't lived an easy life, and his character has been developed through perseverance. For Arnie Johnson, things now seem to be coming together. He was the man of the family. He had given the first money he had saved as a newsboy over many years for his own education. $250 to Hot and Here. To his mother to help her make a down payment on a car so she could drive to work as a cleaning lady at the Holiday Inn or Howard Johnson's or something and not have to walk. They're now at the new house. Before going inside, Arnie and Debbie took a slow walk around the perimeter of the house. Disappointment began to change their enthusiasm. Grass was overgrown everywhere. The backyard was a snarl of briar and brush. The reddish-brown roof was weathered and would soon need repair. Paint was curling off the woodwork. The whole exterior was dry and desperately in need of fresh paint. The front door was weathered. Untrimmed yews stood on either side of the entrance steps, partially obscuring the front windows. And Arnie admitted, "It's worse than I thought." "Yeah, it's pretty bad," said Debbie, "but we'll have the whole thing fixed up by the end of the month." Debbie then told her son, "Jason, we're going in the house now. Come on." Arnie opened the front door, and they stepped into a suffocatingly hot atmosphere that carried an unpleasant, musty smell. Debbie slid open windows to air the place out. Arnie walked back to the front yard, held it open, and called the dog. The dog romped up to the base of the front steps, then stopped. "Come on, boy, come on," Arnie commanded, but the gray and white sheepdog barked and backed away to the center of the lawn. Arnie let the dog have his way, figuring somehow he knew the house was too hot inside. Unlike the exterior, which distinctly required attention, the inside seemed all right. "So far, so good," Debbie reported to Arnie. "Karen, the girl who lived here before, seems to have moved everything out." "How come she moved?" asked Arnie. "Something about getting a divorce, I think. She moved back to Bridgeport with her daughter. The rent was too much for her alone." At the far end of the hall, Arnie opened the door of the right rear bedroom. Debbie and Jason came in a few steps behind to discover a full-size, filled waterbed with a mirrored canopy occupying almost the entire bedroom. "Oh boy," Jason exclaimed, ready to plunge into it. Debbie grabbed him by the shoulder. "Forget it," she says. "It's not ours, and if you broke it, we couldn't afford to replace it. Stay off of it." Though it was still hot in the house, Debbie felt a sudden, distinct chill in the hall just underneath the access door to the pull-down stairs to the attic. "Well, what do you think?" Arnie asked. "I think we ought to unload the car and get the furniture set up," Debbie asked curtly. "Now count me down to the 11:30 opening. I can be interrupted." "No, I mean staying here, paying this kind of high rent for this kind of place." Well, they then discovered that whoever lived in the little cottage adjoining hadn't moved out yet. They then discovered that the room in the basement was locked and they couldn't get into it. And the daughter of the owner came by and told them, no matter what the agreement said, they were prohibited from entering the basement area. She had three younger brothers, Carl, Alan, and David. David was a chubby, happy-go-lucky little boy. I think he's about 11. To finish the moving, they had the three boys picked up to come over and help them. I'm reading another book by Gerald Brittle, author of A Demonologist, again, in conjunction or cooperation with Ed and Lorraine Warren, the demonologists of the other book that we've been reading, including the Annabelle Doll story and the Donovan House. A later happening, The Devil in Connecticut. The whole book's about it. Obviously, I'm not going to read you the whole book. I'm setting the stage. A Connecticut couple from Bridgeport rented a house in Newtown. The couple's name, Arnie and Debbie. Arnie lives with his mother, Mary. Debbie has a small boy, Jason. She has three brothers, the youngest of which is David. As they're moving into this house, just rented, the three boys are picked up, assigned appropriate jobs. Carl was given a putty knife and told to free up the windows that had been painted shut. Alan was issued a broom and instructed to sweep the floors. David was to check all closets and cupboards, throw away any junk that didn't belong there. When they arrived, the dog wouldn't go in the house. The boys set off to perform their duties, little knowing that these would be the last minutes of an innocent childhood. For within the hour, an incident would occur that would mark the beginning of an incomprehensible, diabolical siege that in time would forever change the lives of every member of the Johnson and Gladwell families. All was calm for the better part of an hour, when suddenly the quiet was broken with the boys giggling in a foreroom of the house. Inevitably, they had discovered the waterbed left there by previous tenant, apparently. The adults found Carl, Alan, and Jason rolling around on the waterbed making waves. David, the younger of the three brothers of Debbie, Jason was her boy. David, predictably timid, was reluctant to engage in roughhouse and stood watching from afar. At a stern word from Judy, now Judy is Debbie's mother, who came with the three boys to help with the moving. Got the principles? Carl and Judy Gladzel, a New England family with a daughter Debbie, granddaughter Jason, and three sons, Carl, Alan, and David. Another family, Mary Johnson and her kids and her oldest son, Arnie. Debbie had moved in with the Johnsons, fallen in love with Arnie. Now they've rented a house, Debbie and Arnie and the Johnsons. And Debbie's mother brought the three young lads to help them move. And they're playing in the waterbed. David's looking on. A stern word from Judy, the mother of Debbie and the three boys. And the boys reluctantly got off the bed, trooped out of the room, followed by the adults. However, David stayed in the room. Walking over to the foot of the bed, he noticed the surface was still slightly undulating. He then turned and gazed out the window and saw a light rain begin to fall. Suddenly, incredibly, David felt what seemed to be two large hands, like those of a man, pressing on his stomach. A moment later, David was shoved backward onto the waterbed. He landed flat on his back. At 5 feet tall and weighing 150 pounds, David is a weighty child, and considerable force would be required to knock him over. David quickly turned, expecting to see Jason or one of his brothers making a hasty retreat. But that wasn't the case. When David Glatzel turned to see who had pushed him, his mouth dropped open. You're getting kind of used to this, aren't you? Huh? I mean, that's the whole point. The gestalt is to... Do you realize how much has been going wrong out there in the world? Wrong is right. Going wrong and wrong out there and on out there in the world. Nobody telling you? I'm telling you, if this isn't a true story, It's criminal to print this, Bantam books. This couldn't be true. But it is. David quickly turned, expecting to see Jason, one of his brothers, making a hasty retreat, but that wasn't the case. When David Glatzel turned to see who pushed him, his mouth dropped open. Standing before the boy at the foot of the bed, bearing a wild, menacing look on its face, was a man, or at least the visage of a man. Suddenly, David realized he could see through the man. The child was seized with terror. His body shook. As he watched, the specter slowly lifted its arm and pointed directly at him. You've been expecting me to quit any minute, haven't you? His heart pounding, his body shaking, his mind a swirl, David watched the figure back away and disappear from view. The boy shuddered with cold fear. David moved off the bed slowly, never taking his eyes off the spot where the thing had appeared. He eased out of the room without shifting his gaze. His mind was reeling as he stood in the living room. He couldn't understand what had happened to him, and all he could understand was he was frightened, and the fright was real. When Debbie called him and asked him to help his brother Alan carry a carton into the bedroom where the waterbed was, David gasped and shouted, "No, no, I won't go back in there." "What's the matter with you?" Debbie asked. "Nothing," he said crossly. "I want to go home, Mommy. I just want to go home now. I want to go now." "A little while, David," she said, without looking up the sink she was scrubbing. "I want to go now," he insisted. "I don't want to stay here." "David, I'm sorry, but no." Frightened and feeling totally alone, David ran outside and refused to come back in. He sat with the dog under the tree on the front lawn out of the sprinkling rain. Tears streamed down the little boy's face as he looked back at the dark, now forbidding house. Meanwhile, another strange episode took place in the waterbed room. Carl and Alan had maneuvered the carton into the bedroom and slid it into a corner. When they went to leave, the door closed by itself. No matter how they twisted and manipulated the doorknob, they couldn't get it to open the door. Something was not right. Feeling trapped, Alan and Carl began to yell for help. The sound of their voices should have carried through the empty house, but nobody heard them. "I'll bet you when I'm done this Halloween, pumpkins with ugly faces won't be very scary." When Alan tried to turn the doorknob once again, it functioned perfectly. "Didn't you hear us calling?" Alan asked Debbie. "No," she said. "Why?" "We got locked in that bedroom." "That's neat, Alan. You're real smart," she remarked. "What's David's problem?" Judy asked. "He's bored, I think. Maybe the heat got to him," Debbie answered, and Judy accepted the explanation without comment. A few other things happened. And they rounded up the boys and went back to Glatzel's home in Brookfield, the parents of Debbie. They had worked all afternoon, tired, and at supper that night, I skipped a few things, though Arnie and Debbie were still upset, it was David who was the real problem. Normally bubbly and giggling and full of life, he was now glum and long-faced and refused to talk. Efforts to cheer him up were met with, "Leave me alone, or I don't have to answer you." Eventually, he just got up and walked away, leaving a plate full of food. David Glatzel was carrying a problem he felt no one would believe. Later that night, however, after the other boys had gone to bed, he confided in his brother Alan. "Alan, are you asleep?" "No, why?" "I'm afraid something happened to me today, and I want to tell you, but you have to promise you're not going to laugh and turn on the light, the little one." "Okay, I won't laugh." "Now what?" He turned on the light. "Something happened to me today in that house." "Alan." "Me too. Me and Carl got locked in the bedroom with the waterbed. We couldn't get out. The doorknob wouldn't work." "And then it would." "Really?" David asked relieved. "Yeah, it was scary. What happened to you?" something scary too. In the same room, there was a man in there, Alan, but not a real man, a ghost man. He pushed me down on the waterbed. David had raised his voice, then lowered it to a whisper. What did he look like? He was an old man, and he was wearing regular clothes, but he looked crazy. And he pointed at me, Alan, and he talked too. He was moving like he was real. I mean, he was real, but he was moving too. David, you're scaring me. Alan, I'm scared all over. That's why I'm telling you, I can't sleep. I keep thinking about it. You're not kidding me, are you? I mean, what you're telling me is pretty far out. If you were making this up, that'd be sick, you know. I'm not lying. There was something in that house, and I can see it from here. What do you mean you can see it from here? What do you see? It's there with the dog. Now, having moved the stuff in, they left their sheepdog, George, there. They're back in It's there with the dog. David put his hands up over his eyes as he continued. George is running back and forth in the house. He's going crazy. He just ran down the cellar stairs right now. You can see over inside the house right now, sitting from here. I can see it all, Alan. God, this is serious, David. Are you sure about this? I mean, are you sure? You're sure? Yep, I'm sure. Okay, you say the dog's over there flipping out. What about Arnie and Debbie and Mrs. Johnson, the girls? Tomorrow they're going to move in there. This thing's going after them, you know. I never thought of that, said David, reflecting on his new fear. I've got to tell them. He reasoned out loud, but how you believe me? They'll think I'm nuts. No, they won't, said Alan. I won't let them. We'll just tell them the way it is. David and Alan went into the kitchen. Arnie and Debbie were sitting at the table with Judy. Alan spoke first. David wants to say something, and I think you better listen to him because he's not kidding. Okay, David? David, remember when you chased Jason and Carl and Alan out of the bedroom for being on the waterbed? Right, they all said. I warn you.
No, sir.
I don't believe this. This is the biggest lie I've ever read. It's true. Well, after they were gone, I stayed in the bedroom alone. I walked over to the window, and when I was standing there, I felt two hands push me on my stomach, like when someone pushes you in the pool. I didn't know what was happening. I didn't see nothing yet. And then he pushed me hard, and I fell back on the waterbed. Who pushed you on the waterbed, Judy? His mother asked, frowning. The old man. He was like a ghost or something, David said. David, is this a dream that you just had? You woke up and wanted to tell us about it, Arnie asked. No, it's no dream. Didn't happen tonight. It happened this afternoon, answered David. No one around the table knew what to say. Is that all that happened? I mean, is there more to it, Debbie said. Yeah, there's lots more, David said. It's happening now. Okay, stop, Arnie directed. This doesn't make any sense. Start from the beginning. You're telling us you saw a ghost in the house in the water bedroom? Right. How many times did you see it? Once. Then. But I see him now. You see him? Is it here? Arnie asked. No. It's at the waterbed house. What's he look like? He had gray hair. No, white. And a small mustache. White. There was a mole up by his right eye. That's all you saw, Judy asked, just ahead? No, I saw all of him, David revealed. He was wearing a red plaid shirt, sleeve on the left side, was all torn apart and ragged. His pants were ripped, too. He had old blue jeans, washed out like. There was a hole in the left knee of the pants. He scared me, like I told Alan. He looked crazy, like he might try to hurt me. Was he solid or transparent, Arnie asked. What's that mean, questioned David. See-through, his mother told him. I could see part of the room through him, but not a lot. He was mostly solid. When I first saw him, David continued, he was just standing there like he was letting me see him. I thought he was stiff. But then his arm, his left arm, began to move. He raised it up all the way and pointed his finger at me and stared. Then what, said Judy. Then he talked to me. His finger was pointing straight at me and he said, beware. Beware, Judy repeated with incredulity. This is too much, Debbie declared. Is this some kind of joke, Alan, because it ain't funny. He's telling the truth, Alan said. He's telling you more than he told me. What happened to that after that, David? And he said, nothing really. He just kind of stepped back and faded away. Did he say anything else than beware? Alan asked his brother. Nope, that's all he said during the afternoon at least. What does that mean? Has this thing talked to you again? Oh, yeah, Mom, that's the rest of it. David says he can see inside the house right now. I can do more than that, David said ominously. What are you talking about? What can you do? Judy demanded. Calm down, Mom. Alan cuts in. Enough, Ernie said firmly. I want to hear the rest of this. I want to know what's supposed to be going on there. I don't want to sit in here. I want to sit on the couch, David said, getting grumpy. Accordingly, all got up and moved into the living room. Okay, Ernie asked. Now go on, David. When did it talk to you again? What's this about George? George is the dog. I didn't tell this part to Alan because he told me not to tell anyone that he was there, David divulged. He told me this before, just after I laid down in bed and closed my eyes. Who told you this? The old man, Judy asked. He's not an old man anymore. He changed when the sun went down. Now he's different. I can't see him too clear, but now his body is all red and his face is big and white with black eyes, and coming out of his forehead he grew horns. My God, Judy said. Nervous, Debbie took out a cigarette, picked up the lighter on the coffee table. When she flicked it, the flame roared all the way up to the ceiling. The incident was over in a second, but left all staring in wonder. It's here, Alan exclaimed. No, it isn't, David replied calmly. It's still in the waterbed house. David, he told you not to talk with us. Did he tell you anything else? Yes, David said reluctantly. He told me to take down the holy card of St. Michael in my bedroom. He wants to take all the crucifixes out of the house, too. He told me if I don't do these things, he's going to punish me. Oh, really, Judy mused. Did you obey him? No, David said. I'm not going to. What about George? Alan asked his brother. You were talking about him being scared before. How would you know that, Arnie asked. How would this thing be able to talk to you if he's not here? Because I can't stop it, Arnie, David told him honestly. When I close my eyes, I can see inside the waterbed house just as if I'm there. Same thing happens if I put my hands over my eyes. If I ask you to put your hands over your eyes, David, would you be able to see George now? Yes, David replied. But don't want to. I don't want to see the ghost man. Okay, Arnie said, but can you tell me what you know about the dog? He was in the basement before. He was scratching real hard at the door to that locked room downstairs. That's where the ghost man comes from. He was scratching it so hard he made one of his paws bleed. The ghost man goes back and forth between the waterbed and the downstairs room. When George sees him, his eyes turn red and he runs in circles. He scratched up the inside of the front door, too. That's all I know. Well, this goes on. Finally, they tell him, I don't want to hear more about ghosts, ghost man, or nothing. David, Alan, you go to bed. I want to sleep and talk tomorrow. This nonsense will be a thing of the past. And they wrote it off as a kid's imagination. Thursday, July 3rd. Can we continue? 1980. Thursday began in the Glatzel house with three important questions directed at David. Do you remember what we were talking about last night, David? Debbie asked. I remember, he said, the ghost man. That's right, but was everything you told us last night true? Everything, David said. And is that figure, that beast, still in the house today? Yet, he's still there. He knows you're coming.
This is the end of Side 3. For more of the teaching, please turn the tape over for Side 4. Thank you.